Leadership is taking people on a journey where there's a vision, guidance, and purpose.
Good leaders lead with the heart as well as the head.
Leadership means doing the right thing for the right reason, no matter how difficult it might be.
You're listening to Leadership Unwrapped, a podcast where you will hear from people who are living leadership every day.
Hi, Niamh. I have to say I really enjoyed the conversation with Liam that we're going to share with our listeners today. So lots of people that I know that know Liam describe him as the coach's coach. And I know when the listeners are going to hear from him, they're going to understand why. He's vastly experienced in training coaches and in coaching himself, but he's so committed to it. And, you know, the more that he chats about it, the more you get insight into why he's just blown away so much by it and why he loves it so much.
Also, when he's talking about his experiences in teaching as well, because I guess a lot of what I heard about him was within that profession, within when he moved more into the coaching space. But the passion that you can tell he has when he speaks about his time within schools is just incredible. And his love of teaching is really evident. And it's clear that that's really impacted the rest of his career as well.
Yeah, he absolutely lit up when he was talking about some of the young men that he was teaching. His whole face, his whole everything.
Yeah.
Just because we did it in person, but and I love being with teachers who think like that, who really like kids. You had a real sense that he just had great fun. He enjoyed who they were and how they were. And, you know, that even in later life, that he still has a sense of how their lives are going and that he's connected. Just loved it. Thought it was really cool.
Yeah, there was the same sense of enjoyment from him, whether it was a story of something that went particularly well or something that went a little bit awry as well, wasn't there? So,
Totally.
It was lovely, lovely to hear. And I know we spoke afterwards about just how naturally he made lots of references to lots of different types of literature. And he's such a truly well-informed and well-read individual. And, you know, you could really feel the human centeredness about him as well, and how much he cares about the person before all else. It was just a hugely interesting conversation and a real privilege to speak with someone like Liam.
Yeah, I just like when people can draw from novels. I mean, I know he talked about John McGoohan and others, but to be able to draw from that space as well as from the other literature that influences our work, the professional literature, for want of a better word, but to be able to just blend them together and draw from them. I just love that when you're talking to someone like that. It just gives another depth, another bit of extra piece to the conversation. But he's also very family oriented. If you can remember the way he talked about his mom and talked about his grandfather, just everything about how he spoke is really rooted, grounded kind of person, which I know a friend of mine had said, you're really going to like talking to this guy. And 100% that was the case. So he shared a photograph with us. And it was a photograph, listeners will hear about it, and I won't do a spoiler here. But I want to say, I still take it out. It's in my diary and I still take it out and I still look at it. And I think, do you know, like, it's really the points around how we influence each other and how we grow into being by watching what other people do. Just blown away. I still see it. I think it was a really good example. First time somebody's brought something like that to our conversation. But it really was such a good prompt to get us thinking. Look, we won't give it all away here now. Yeah. We're doing spoilers, so I'm going to stop on that one. So listeners, we'll stop talking about the conversation and maybe let you listen to the conversation and send us a message just to give us some feedback. We'd be delighted to hear from you. So I'm delighted to welcome Liam to the podcast today. And I'd heard a lot about Liam and became aware of Liam when he received his honorary doctorate from the University of Limerick there recently, but also had been hearing a lot about his work from different colleagues in the sports sciences here at the University of Limerick. So it was a real treat when we contacted Liam and he said yes, that he would join us. And so by way of introduction, Liam was born and raised in Tuam, County Galway, where his passion for sport began, and he quickly became an accomplished athlete and won his first of many county senior titles in Galway as a schoolboy. He graduated from Thomond College in 1978 with a Bachelor of Arts in Physical Education and Environmental Studies. After graduating, he moved to Dublin, where he taught physical education, geography, maths and history. Liam's reputation grew nationally and internationally during his long association with the then National Coaching and Training Centre, which has since been renamed Coaching Ireland. In 1992, Liam piloted the first cross-sport introduction to coaching course for coaches in several sports, including rugby, soccer, athletics, GAA and swimming. Since 1994, Liam has led 35 tutor development courses that cater for over 50 sports. He remains actively involved in sport and coaching since his retirement in 2017, but I'm not sure he has really retired. And he currently chairs the GAA National Coaching Committee, is a member of Canoe Ireland and Paralympics Ireland High Performance Committees, and he retains responsibility for the FEI Coach Education Programme. Like I've said, he holds an honorary degree of Doctor of Letters from the University of Limerick and is affectionately known in Irish sport as the coach's coach, always emphasising the importance of developing the person before the coach through a continual cycle of learning. So Liam, super welcome after that introduction. We'll see how we get on.
Thank you very much.
You said yes. Thank you.
No, delighted to be back down on campus. I have some great memories of here. Only great memories here, to be honest.
Good to know.
Thanks for inviting me. Yeah, good to know.
Yeah, what I think is lovely about this is because Giles spoke about you so much in his recording that there's almost like an introductory piece for the listeners as well, you know, coming into this conversation, which is so nice as well.
And for those who know us, I mean, Giles and I started working together in what was the National Coaching and Training Centre.
Yeah.
And very different sides of a continuum, the coaching, the technicolor, as I said, and the science and the black and white. Both needed the what and the how.
Yeah.
And saw each other as being different or divergent or whatever, one side of the house and the other side of the house.
Mm.
I suppose very quickly, and it was quickly, saw that, no, that there's a huge overlap here. And the more we began to work with people and share ideas or problems, the more we saw we needed each other. And I think that's the way the disciplines have moved on, and that's the way Giles and I have moved on as well. We need each other.
Yeah. Or you could say that you just brought him over to the dark side if you wanted to.
I kept him.
Only teasing Giles if he's listening to this. Yeah. Because he's a keen proponent of coaching. He certainly is deeply committed to it and sees the value of it. I would imagine your work together has helped that.
Hugely so. There is that what and the how, they say, easily enough of coaching. And a lot of the books that you'd see that purport to be about coaching are really content dominated. They're about the what or the sciences, the evidence, these things you can see. Whereas coaching is really how you disseminate, communicate, get through that science to let other people do it. Mm-hmm. So that balance of the what and the how is a difficult one, because you can clearly see the what. The how can seem seamless or invisible. So when you meet someone like Giles who has worked on both sides and credits it, he can lift the entire thing as a result and bring the value of knowledge and science into a place where it's applied very well and applied appropriately. And it isn't easy to get that gap or to get that connection.
So you started out as a teacher. And you've circumlocuted around the place a bit, I think, in terms of your journey. But tell us a little bit about your career journey for our listeners.
Okay. I have been lucky. And when I say that, a lot of people push back and say, oh, no, but you've done this, and this. But I have been tremendously lucky. I mean, taking out the great setting, I'm the eldest of six children born in Tuam County, Galway. But three significant steps happened that did prove how lucky I was. A Christian brother came teaching in Tuam the same time as I went attending the secondary school, a brother, Willie Morgan from Innisdiamond in County Clare. He was, I've always credited him as the first adult to encourage me to think for myself.
Okay.
Now, I'll come back to that, but that was deeply significant at a time where if you did what you were told, life was comfortable.
Mm-hmm.
And out of that thinking, he also got us as not a deference to authority, but a respect for authority, but a questioning of it.
Yeah.
And that never happened before. So that was a huge, significant thing. I had no control on that. The second one is when I did my Leaving Cert, NCTC, or NCPE, the National College of Physical Education, was set up here on campus.
Mm-hmm.
The only thing that was in UL campus was the White House and what's now called the
Pest
Building.
Yeah, wow, I
know. Yeah.
Time ago.
Oh, yeah, and a huge positivity in Ireland about there's now going to be trained PE teachers.
Mm.
Now, we were all grasping with the concept of what is a PE teacher. And we grasped and hang on to that tightly for a very long time. So I got caught up in that second wave, if you like. And I was teaching approximately 20 years when National Coaching and Training Centre was set up that happened to be located back on campus. And that was the first ever integrated approach for all governing bodies, all sports. So before, hockey would be together, it would be with themselves only, basketball, athletics. They might meet for ceremonies at the end of the year, but this was an integrated approach where people from all the various sports would come to learn about the how of coaching.
Mm.
So there were three very significant steps. Look. And then there was look that one of the governing bodies I worked on with the equestrian body, Horse Sport Ireland, that did show jumping, dressage and so forth.
Yeah.
There was no such international model. So when the international body got curious about what was happening, I happened to be the Irish contact, so they spread my wings all over the country as well. Each of those hubs, Brother Morgan, the NCPE, NCTC and the FEI, all of them taught me about the value of discomfort, because none of those hops were easy. All of them got me out of secure comfort zones. And I suppose, unconsciously, I did value then that education or improvement or a change only, well, came best out of stretching. Struggle with steps towards better achievements. So the more struggles and the fight or the struggle to overcome that, the better the success would be at the end.
Yeah. So at those times, at each of those steps, because you're describing them as luck, but also as discomfort in a way, at the time, did you think, like, I'm lucky that this, for any of them, I'm lucky that this opportunity has come up? Or was it like, oh, Jesus, this is a lot now?
Oh, Jesus.
Yeah.
I was in secondary school at a time when physical punishment was commonplace. You'd get slapped every day. It was just a different time.
Yeah, it was.
But I would have been far more uncomfortable in Brother Morgan's classes originally than I would in a class where I potentially would have got slapped.
Wow, yeah.
Yeah, because I can, and I've said it often, I can clearly remember him saying to me, and what do you think of that, Liam? And the pressure, the sweat, the rash, just make life easy, Brother Morgan, just hit me and tell me the answer.
Yeah, tell me the answer, exactly.
And likewise in college, I didn't see it at the time, but we did have some great leaders who were lecturers who were only a year or two older than us. They too were struggling with how trained physical education teachers were to fit in. And I started teaching in Ord School Reach in Dublin. And it says nothing of the training I got here, which was great and I loved it. But really after a month, I realised that very little of what I'd learned here helped me really connect with young Northside Dublin lads.
Yeah. Mm.
That was uncomfortable.
Yeah.
And you had to learn that on the move and very, very quick. Athletics and basketball were the two sports I was most comfortable with. So then I come to NCTC and you're dealing with all kinds of sports. There's another big hop. So it was a life of planning, life of late nights, a life of sweating. Started with a big head of hair. and delighted these steps were taken.
Yeah. And was it difficult to leave the teaching in the classroom in school behind you to move into that? Or were you ready for that change?
I love teaching.
Can you remember?
Love teaching. Love the boys. The school is 50 years old this year, so there's been many opportunities to reconnect with a lot of them.
Nice.
Again, a bit of luck. The head of the coach education department at that stage, the director in NCTC, was a guy called John Kerwin, was Pat Duffy. Now, Pat and I were friends. We played basketball. We ran, cycled in France. We did a lot together. So Pat actually approached me to take a year off teaching to help start developing what became NCTC and the integrated approach. 1 year became five.
Mm.
I did return to teaching, and then in 98 I started working full time.
Yeah, yeah.
But I was always a teacher.
Mm. Yeah.
A teacher of younger boys and then a teacher of adults.
Mm.
The difference being, I suppose, when I was with some of the boys, the real energy had to be put in when you were with them. That was the tough part. When I was teaching committed adults, the real energy had to be done beforehand so that you could go more with the flow and address their needs, that they weren't going to be disruptive or whatever.
Yeah.
Not that the lads were too much either. But it still brought in that concept. You got to work here. You have a privileged position. There is a responsibility.
Yeah.
And sometimes it'll work, and sometimes my mother used to talk about her Monaghan's mother of things. If you made a mistake, encourage you to make. I don't know why she ever said that, but she did encourage. You made a right Monaghan's mother of that. It was never negatively reflective.
Yeah.
But I did value making planned mistakes was a good way of learning.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's really interesting what you're saying in terms of the, you know, the energy that it takes in the classroom with teenagers or younger, and the difference in teaching adults and just the different approaches. It is a different draw of energy in when I think about it myself, but it still needs that same energy from us, but deployed in different ways, I think. I hadn't thought about that before, but that resonates well for me.
Yes. Yeah. I think all teachers should, whether they're in university, primary schools, I think they all should end the day tired.
Yeah.
If you're not tired, there's something going wrong, because it is hugely demanding.
Yeah.
The product, our children, the product is the human mind.
Mm.
It's far more pliable than anything a sculptor would work, or an artist or a musician would work with.
Mm.
And it's totally unpredictable. And if you are successful in day one or week one or month one, it has changed fundamentally from the one you started with a day or a week or a month ago. So you got to move with them.
Yeah.
They don't go away.
Yeah.
Yeah. So one of the great arts, I think, is teaching. I think it's one of the great professions. Mm. Yeah.
Yeah, I hate to see it come under so much critique in the media sometimes about the teaching itself. I mean, we do need to be accountable for our work as teachers. I always believe in that, but sometimes there's just a bash like against teaching, you know, that 3 months off in the summer and all these holidays and all these various things, without recognition of just the emotional labor of the work.
Huge.
And the commitment that goes into it, the care that goes into it as you do the work.
And it's not about the teachers. It's about the students in every case. And 3 months, it isn't about life being spent in school. There's other ways of improving and of learning and spending time with people. It took me a while to use the phrase that I don't coach basketball or I don't coach athletics. I would have described myself as that for a while. But I coach people who run, jump and throw. I coach people who ride horses. You're not an Irish teacher. You're a teacher of students.
Of children.
Yeah.
And there's no in-services of that. I don't think so now anyway. There was in-service for history and Irish and geography when I was in secondary school. But there was never an in-service for teaching young people.
And
I describe
100%.
Coaching. Yeah, I describe coaching as a way of helping people develop social skills by interacting with others.
Mm.
And that's where that connection to people comes about.
And
great coaches coach or teach people.
Yeah.
Good coaches or teachers coach the subject. And there's a way of the difference.
Yeah. I wonder, do you think that approach came from your experience in teaching of when you're looking at coaching, then that you're coaching the person? Or do you think that's just a disposition or a values that you had that you brought to that space? Or did it come from the teaching?
I think it came quickly from the teaching, Eva.
Mm.
I mean, I loved it here in college. I was crazy about running at the time, particularly. Basketball a little second. I met my wife in college, so those three crazinesses going on in my life. But I just saw the diversity in every classroom was what I felt immediately. I'm not ready for this. There's some of them enthusiastic, there's some of them not enthusiastic, there's some of them tall, there's some of them small, there's some of them talkative. So very quickly, a reality hit me that it isn't a subject I'm teaching here. They're looking back at me.
Mm.
There's personalities here, completely different personalities. Yep. And I like the phrase now that personalities are best when they're released in a measured way. So I began to stretch the measures. So get rid of red lines. There were some absolutes now we're teaching kids, so there's legal, moral and ethical guidelines. Yeah. But to really within that have a very broad approach to it.
Mm-hmm.
So it did take me time to get away from compulsory PE, mandatory gear, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
And really when I let go of that, those who didn't want to take part, if they didn't have a note or whatever, but I made the class so interesting that they'd be looking on thinking, God, I want to be part of that.
Yeah.
Mm.
So work with those who wanted to work with, while not ignoring the others, giving them some job or whatever.
Yeah.
Difficult in a formal setting to train people to be that diverse. You did need the structure of plan, do, review, questions, outcomes, time management.
Yeah.
You did need all that. And then when you had all that, you had to scatter it all aside, or maybe leave it all aside and look Johnny and Mary in front of you.
Mm.
Phil Conway had a big impression on me. He was a great PE teacher in Belvedere College.
Mm.
And they had a phrase there, if you want to teach Latin to John, you must know Latin and you must know John.
Oh, yeah.
No girls there, John or Jane or whatever.
Yeah.
But you see the point. So the Latin doesn't change. It hasn't changed since I was. Mm. But John and Jane, my God, do they change.
Yeah. Mm.
So it's that search for that sweet spot between the what and the how.
Mm-hmm.
My God, you get it wrong.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. And I think we all do. But I was talking about something similar this week, and I was saying that the curriculum is just the vehicle through which we teach about life and how to live. So when we're stuck so slavishly to the outcomes must be, we're missing the big picture, which is that we're teachers of children first, mm-hmm. or of people, depending on your setting. And I think when you're in initial teacher education, that's a slow burn piece of information. I think you have to grow into it a bit.
Yeah.
But we are teachers of children first, in my view, I think.
We like certainty, you know, and again, in sport, which I'm my most familiar background, is, you know, things like high performance body set up. There's top class coaches brought in college here, you know, there'll be doctors, there'll be professors. Mm-hmm. We set up this atmosphere of certainty. These people know stuff. And it becomes difficult to express an uncertainty or I don't know. I don't know what we're doing. And I think when you reverse things over, that the best things start with the problem. We actually don't know how to fix this. So as a coach, rather, I don't know how best to deal with this person. I can't transform them. They're totally in charge of that. I can't improve them. They're in charge of that. I think when we start with the idea that it's a problem, we begin to reach out into a place where we can help them best at that point.
Mm.
All good things start with a problem.
Yeah. I work with a colleague and she, you know, we might be doing a piece of work and she literally put on the brakes and say, we need to problematize this now a small bit.
Yeah.
But it's that same kind of, it's that same idea. And in doing it, she's trying to make sure that we start reaching out in all different directions rather than what's comfortable in solving. And you're reminding me for now when you say coming at it from that direction.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I've mentioned this a few times, Patricia. I suppose that's the things I've mentioned a while, but I came up with the concept of the boyo, so extending personality. I wanted people who'd ask questions, mm-hmm. ask why, people who might do your head in.
Yeah.
These are the kind, even in school, the guys who did what they were asked to do in school were not the guys I really ideally wanted to come for after school activities. The guys that might be doing your head in during the school, question you, getting up, going out with Kalagam Dullan Ma, not having the exit. I loved them afterwards. So I had this concept of the boyo. But my girls mentioned one time that the slides I had were all of men. So my girls were in their 20s at the time, and we sat down, well, what's the female equivalent of a boyo? Girl who didn't fit.
Mm-hmm.
And they came up with Maria from the Sound of Music, if they were the gibbet.
Yeah.
Will of the Wisp.
Yeah.
The clown. I thought, yeah, I love that.
Yeah, I love that too.
But when I went to look at the words, that chorus starts with,
How do you solve a problem like Maria?
We see people who think for themselves as problems.
Yeah.
And really those people that I mentioned are those, Brother Morgan, the NCTC, they were all set up, they were either individuals or systems that were set up to solve a problem. Now, individuals working within systems,
mm-hmm.
we don't die for system, but the individuals, that's the great start. So starting with an area of certainty might be comfortable. That seldom ever works, I find.
Mm. It frightens me about how unwelcome. Well, two things. How pushback and questioning is weaponized at one level, and I don't want to get into the politics of that too much, or we can if we need to. But it actually silences the place of asking the question. And that's happening. So people, I'm seeing a reluctance in people now to just, if they don't know, throw out, I don't know how to speak about this issue, or I don't know if I agree or I don't agree, but I'd like to be able to figure out if I do or not in a conversation with you. That's less safe now than it would have been even 20 years ago. It's almost like we're going full circle a little bit. I don't know if you find that, but that worries me.
Yeah, I think that loyalty is overrated. You know, even the whole idea of a tribe, you know, the way we divide people in Ireland, we had a discussion about Kerry or Galway. This tribalism separates us from others. And loyalty is certainly something I would have emphasised or pushed, but the more I saw about it, it closed our minds. Because we saw the people that weren't loyal as being others. They're not like us.
That's interesting. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and it's easy to call names in that kind of
thing. Yeah.
And a lot of the examples photographically that I remember of loyalty were maybe small fish all darting out of the way of a big whale, or birds flying loyal to each other, mm-hmm, you know, the V shape. Mm-hmm. But really, I think the bird at the top of the V just gets tired. They just get tired and they back off.
Mm-hmm,
and
that's right.
Then they don't want to be lost and they come in with the group. The small fish see the big whale and individually, selfishly, instinctively, they move. And that's different from a trained loyalty. They're actually thinking of themselves first and then working together.
Mm.
And you can see the way we treat whistleblowers often. I mean,
oh, yeah.
They pop their head up and we knock it off. So living with people who think for themselves and act it out quite quickly can be very difficult.
Mm.
But if we allow the scope for thinking,
mm-hmm,
John McGarren said that we go to school to learn to think for ourselves.
Mm.
It's great verbs there. Yeah. Go, learn and think.
Yeah.
We can't learn for them. So I think that loyalty, even school uniforms, which I thought were a great idea, but it differentiates us, you know, when they leave the school, they're the people from that school, from that school.
This is really interesting to me because I've been thinking a lot about children and COVID and my experience and it is different for all families, so I'm putting that out there, and there are equity and inequity issues with it, but my experience in my home about the freedom to choose a little bit around how my son wanted to learn and what he wanted to learn and what he wanted to devote his energy to, I got insights that I had no idea of, skills or openness or thoughtfulness that in the busyness of getting to school every day and getting to work every day we had missed.
Yeah.
So there was something really unique in just taking off the rigidity of the structuring, mm-hmm, of the schooling to allow the space to think.
Yeah.
And it wasn't all about just being locked in a bedroom on a screen. Actually, there was other stuff going on as well,
yeah,
that got space that it wouldn't alternatively have got.
Yeah.
That's been fascinating to me.
Well, that's why my response to that, Patricia, is really that the coaching, that description of coaching, it's about helping people. So now that's where they reach out with. Develop social skills. Well, they can question and they can listen and they can wait and they can be patient and kind and generous and honest. But by interacting with others, and that's, mm-hmm, where really the character develops. That it's easy nowadays for people to be segregated to some individual pursuit. So they can actually be disconnected from the group, from the team, from the family, from the community, if they don't have these social skills. Mm-hmm. So they might be great academically. They might be great at a whole pile of different things, playing the guitar, playing the piano, doing all the various things. But really, if you're to get affirmation for it or provide value for that, you've got to be part of the community.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
And I had a school principal who one time mentioned to me, I lied to him when he asked me if I understand what he was talking about. But he said, "Do you know, Lean, all hierarchy is service." And I says, "Yes, I understand what you mean," but I didn't.
Yeah.
But I think all our duty when we're there is to serve. Now, how best can this person learn? Everyone can learn. Not on the same day, not in the same way. Our search is, how can we nail it? What's the sweet spot today?
Yeah.
Not in the same year, not in the same generation, not in the same decade. Look what we find now with so many adult learning, what they're how great they find they are.
But if I'm of the similar view about hierarchy being about service, I try and live that value. It's very important to me. And when I started out thinking about hierarchy, I thought that was just power and game playing and you know, like pyramid where one rises to the top and the rest don't. But the more that I understood that hierarchy can serve if it is done in service with the right value system behind it. If we came at leadership with that more sort of clued in way of thinking about it, we'd literally change the face of leadership across education, which I would like to see. I think it would be worth it.
I think if you trust people, you increase the potential of developing leaders. Now, that means there may be errors. You know, we talk about learning best through trial and error. Very few people will actually admit to the error. Now, if there's learning in that way, there has to be a mistake. But I think if you trust people and are there to pick up the pieces, mm-hmm, and help them start again,
mm-hmm,
you develop thinking types of people. Whereas if you tell people what to do as a leader, you'll only really have servants or workers or people who depend on you. They're not yeah. interdependent. Mm-hmm. They're not capable, confident people in their own right.
Yeah.
Yeah. Or people that are afraid to make a mistake then, isn't it? If you don't have the trust, you're less inclined to put yourself out there and to, yeah.
Or the reaction of what's supposed to be the hierarchy or the leader of the mistake.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
That's really important.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think that idea of I'm still thinking about that idea of loyalty and kind of the identity that is formed because of that. Like, I recently was over in England and I was in a relatively newly formed multi-academy trust where they had brought lots of schools together to come under the one trust. And it was really interesting to see you had lots of different schools that had their own identities and their own culture, norms and so on. Yeah. But they were coming together to be part of this broader umbrella. And yeah. it's kind of like, how much of you as a student and is your identity going to this particular school versus the whole trust? And even the teachers and their experiences of that, like, did they want a shared uniform or they wanted to keep the same uniform? Yeah. And, you know, it's really, really interesting how deeply embedded that loyalty and that identity can go.
Yeah. Mm. And I mean, sometimes it's like helping some life in future by looking in my rear view mirror of my life. Now, there are lessons you can learn, but tomorrow is a day neither of us have lived, or next week or whatever. We're going to different places. There's a great line in Paul Brady's song, The Island, up here, we sacrifice our children to feed the worn out dreams of yesterday.
Mm.
Now, I think so much of education is really about that. We become set in our ways.
Yeah.
This is the way we do it in this school. This is the way we measure it.
Yeah.
I will put in a blast for the Saw Doctors, the greatest live rock and roll band in the world. Ursula van der Leyen quoted this in The Dáil when she visited. They have a lovely line at the end of a song to win just once. They say, to bear your soul for all to find, an honest heart and an open mind.
Yeah.
Now, they're wonderful words, but they're bloody difficult.
Yeah, that's courage walking now.
Yes, bear your soul for all, an honest heart and an open mind.
Yeah.
Whereas the flip side of that is the thing that we, I think, more intuitively recommend, a mindset. We have a mindset.
Yeah.
We set is rigid.
Mm-hmm.
It's solid. It's immovable. And we get comfort in that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
The power of don't know. So I think more of that exposure now, if you bear your soul for all to find, you need people to listen.
Mm-hmm.
You need to be able to speak. You need to be able to ask questions. You need to be able to take risks. So that development of the person, if that precedes the stuff that they learn, the stuff becomes very easy.
Yeah.
You've developed a learning metabolism here.
Mm.
But we often bypass the complexity of the person to get to the stuff.
Yeah.
The stuff is in the way. Yeah.
I think the personal development piece, and I know that's it's a very important dimension of coaching, but that's the foundation to be able to do that kind of work. So if you're comfortable in your skin, if somebody is disagreeing with you, when you do open up your heart in that way, that you're not annihilated by that, but you think, okay, that's where you are. This is where I am. Let's find a mutual ground here in the middle, and nobody's annihilated in that process. But that you need to do a bit of personal work to be comfortable in your skin to be able to go into that space, I think.
Yeah. I mean, all beliefs are strong and set because that we feed and nourish and support those beliefs. But part of the development of those beliefs is that we think those who don't believe that are whack jobs or whatever.
Yeah.
Or we call them names or whatever. So if I don't believe, my immediate reaction might be, well, I'm not going to listen to you.
Yeah, yeah.
So I'm shutting you out.
Yeah.
And it will weaken me if I do.
Yeah.
And a lot of our politics, a lot of our schools, a lot of our communities are run on that. You're either with us or
you're not.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So again, it gets back to that development of the person.
Yeah. I think the image that you brought us kind of ties in with this. I think we'll have to share Liam, when Liam was joining us, just for the listeners, he brought an image with us that, as we say, we'll share. Liam, do you want to
describe it for us?
Okay, well, I suppose if I just pick a number, I may have shown 500 or 600 slides during my career, you know, many times. But now when I meet some of the people who have been on courses, it's amazing how often they'll say, oh, remember that slide of the two men and the boy? And they do remember it. Now, the slide is of two men. It's from behind, so two tall men and a boy of about 2 years of age walking behind them. They obviously have the same barber because they have the same... they're looking down at their feet. And the immediate thing is, wow, the boy has learned how to walk just like them in 2 years.
Yeah.
So the culture of the place has intruded.
Yeah.
But when you look closely at it, the man on the right is holding his thumb. That's mm-hmm. how he keeps the hands together. The man on the left has a hold of his wrist. And the young boy is interlocking his fingers. So what I like about it, it accepts culture and the way we do it, legal, moral and ethical guidelines, our responsibility and accountability.
Mm-hmm.
And within it, it allows this expression of personality. It allows your one way of doing it.
Yeah.
Everyone can learn, not in the same way, not in the same day. And we're the better because of the differences rather than the sameness of it. And that's what the real great educators are able to spark off, the acceptance that we are different and we're better because of that. That is not easy.
You know, what really struck me when you spoke about it, it's an absolutely stunning image. I really love it. But what struck me was that sometimes when in the theory space of the work that we do, we talk about how culture saturates everything that we operate from, the culture that we're imbued with. And we talk about this habitus, produce habitus. In other words, that you're operating from this culture and you don't even know that you are, is the kind of almost the way of thinking about it. And it's quite a negative positioning about culture, but you didn't come in with that way of thinking. You brought in this, there's a culture and an enculturation piece, but there's an individuality inside in it.
Yeah.
And I was really struck by that. That's a very unique way of looking at it, which I liked.
And that's what the great politicians, teachers, lecturers, coaches, whatever, they work with people. Going back to Giles, the impact he's had on me, he talked about 6 capacities if you're trying to improve people, starting off from my world of coaching, but it can be anything. Technical, tactical, mental, physical, and lifestyle management and personal qualities. Now, if we put the lifestyle management and personal qualities as the bridge of a seesaw, to be honest, so over time, people, the culture takes it. We speak the way we speak because of the way the people speak around us. We walk the way we do because of the way people walk around us. So that base is very, very important.
Mm-hmm.
But balanced on that, we have the technical on one side, the mental and the physical. Technique is easy. That's the stuff. It's a servant, not a god.
Mm-hmm.
And the outer end is physical. We can see physical improvements very quickly. And that's why when we get into the passion of running or whatever, we get into a body type and shape and we're delighted, and hence we want to run all the more. But the other two, tactics is really decision making.
Yeah.
And it's done by the person. Mental fitness is the state of mind to help you perform to your best. And that's the remit of the person. So I think at the outer end, the technical and the physical is what we'll say good people work on, because it's the stuff. Easily measured and easily achieved. The great people work on the tactics, the decision making. We're separated not by our talents, but by our choices and the state of mind and the toughness to get into that state of mind. That's where we can have culture, but the individuality of growing people within it. So we reach out, we reach in, we get in there to the deeper. Backyards are more important, more interesting than front gardens. Upstairs in a house is more interesting.
That is true.
So when we leave that awful certainty of technique and physical thing and now get into the heart and soul of that complex, unique person, more difficult, but by God, more interesting. Way more interesting.
So you have a very person-centered, unique kind of approach to your coaching from what I'm hearing in the way that you're talking about it. So maybe do you want to tell us a little bit about what that approach is and what drives that approach for you?
Okay. Well, let's say in the way I approach it mostly, Patricia, let's say I'm working with generally the kind of people I'd be working with would have experience. They'd be adults. Mm-hmm. And they would have a certain amount of knowledge and experience already. But I think even if I work with a five-year-old, they have a 5 years of experience.
Yeah.
And they have a certain amount of knowledge. So the way I approach things is try to give out tasks, to ask questions, to have group work, to let's see where they're at the moment, and then be able to relate to that. At the upper end of performance, if I was able to talk about sport, if I'm working with a show jumper, say, and I'm asking them to solve things, they have a problem, how do they fix it? Together we can work on that as long as I have a red line on the safety, because I wouldn't know too much about it.
Mm.
But if they turn back to me and say, well, now, what's the next step? I don't know that. I would have, if I was working with them, to need to know the stuff, as I call it, a lot more. So what I try to do is to pull out answers, extract answers by giving tasks.
Okay.
So that would be a way of going, mm-hmm. I would have, rather than I really have a very strong red line that telling doesn't work.
Yeah, mm. It doesn't work.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I give you an example. Recently, I was asked to go into a local primary school in Ashburn. I haven't been in a primary school for years. 52 9-year-olds to talk about mental fortitude and resilience. And I thought, yikes.
Yeah, I know. It's like, that's a lot. Tall order.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
So I did prepare. I had a planner that, and I decided to have them in groups of four, and I would give a task. I would give them a prop, and I'd ask them to make up a story about the prop, of how that prop might give an example of resilience. Goalkeeper's gloves was one about protection. The hardest shot, the last line of defence. Mm-hmm. They came up with wonderful stuff. But one I gave the spelling of the word resilience to, gave it to them in a big poster, and they had to come up with some other words from the word resilience. But a word, if it had some relationship to resilience. 50% of the 52 kids were not born in Ireland, and there were only 9. So the others told their stories, and they went down to that group, and the word that they agreed with was sincere. So as I took it from them and says, look, fair play to you, great. In the back of my head, I was thinking, they had no idea the task, really, sincere. And as I'm walking up to the top of the class, I see out of the words resilience, sincere. They were right. It's there.
Yeah.
So on those few steps, again, as part of the letting go, I learned so much.
Mm-hmm. It's incredible.
I'd never have come up with it.
Mm.
So suppose my modus operandi is that the learner has a lot of the answers,
yeah,
for progress. Now, we may then come to a line where the learner is stuck and I'm stuck. And there's the relationship. My job is to help people develop cert. We go together.
And yeah.
By God, when you work to find solutions to something that neither of us easily solved, you have that lesson for life.
Yeah.
So it's to see the genius in, I didn't in that group, and I must say when they presented the word sincere, this voice went, look, great, great attempt, but you didn't understand me.
Yeah.
You
know? Yeah. And then the penny dropped.
They were far, far wiser than I was.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. But there's a flexibility in that. The brain being open to letting the penny drop as you were walking back, that allowed it to go in instead of the position taking of the miss the task.
And luckily I had a few steps to take to have.
Yeah. Yeah. And, but that's key actually in a lot of our work, isn't it? Those few steps, those interweaving moments that we don't pay account to, the walking between two rooms. Like, it's a lot of work happening,
yeah,
as in processing as we do that sort of transitioning between. We underestimate it.
Well, I suppose that's the review part, Bridget. Like, I've talked a fair bit about planning maybe and the implementation. There's a friend of mine who says, nobody will see the amount of time you spend planning, but they'll know in a minute that you didn't.
Mm-hmm.
But the plan can really only be reviewed if there's something tangible there to lean on after the doing. After, let's say you plan a class, you deliver a class. If you haven't the written planner, the actual energy or the learning from the class can dissipate.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas if you now sit down either yourself to reflect or with others, I think that review is all the stronger if you have some type of a drawing or a plan or a diagram or an intention that's tangible. The other person can see it.
Yeah.
But from what I see in education, it's such a race, and the demands to get to classrooms, to do certain hours, and the trust to sit down with a colleague and say, look, hold on, I'm having huge difficulties here.
Yeah.
But the colleague beside you, because they go into a different room, they might have all the solutions. We just need to give each other time to... Mm. All good things take time.
Yeah. Mm. And thoughtfulness, I think that's the... In the pace of work and teaching now, the space for thoughtfulness is... I used to love when I was teaching in my school, I had a half an hour to the school and a half an hour home. And people would say, oh, would you not move closer to... I was like, not a hope. It was my golden time where I would be processing maybe some of the things and probably talking to myself, knowing me, but in the car. But then, because when you're reflecting, the ideas can become a little bit clearer to you. Mm. By the time I'd get home, I'd write a few notes before I'd go into the house, just words. Yeah. But you'd have them to hang on to so that there would be a chance to pick up on them the following day.
Yeah.
But if you don't have that time, they get lost. They dissipate.
Yeah. We have the time, but I think we got to make it. And I think accepting the responsibility that we have in that role of hierarchy or in that role of service, you know, we're there to serve and to mm-hmm. offer. I think it's a duty to reflect. It's a duty to look and back on what worked there or what can I do better. Mm-hmm. I talk about these personal improvement goals, PIGs, but we should always be striving to go for those. Nothing is perfect.
So if
we reach it, we need to lift the bar again.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And I think having a few PIGs around you is probably a very good idea. Just, you know, like making, just even putting them down and just writing them out and thinking about what you, why is that one important? And hanging on to it, I think, is...
And the key is important. The first word is personal.
It's personal. Yeah.
Good wood doesn't grow with ease. The stronger the breeze, the stronger the trees. I've always liked that. And in my head, I see this, you know, this sapling bending and wobbling and over. And it gets stronger and stronger and stronger. And something wonderful comes out of it.
Yeah.
You know, it's the acorn within the oak.
Yeah.
But if that's very, very well supported... And then when the supports come off, the wind comes, bang, it smashes.
Yeah.
So good wood doesn't grow with ease. The stronger the breeze, the stronger the trees.
Love that. Yeah,
I love it.
The more we bob and weave, but how many of us bob and weave and just take a risk?
Yeah, I remember a coach saying to me a bit ago, it's about 6 or 7 years ago now, I was dealing with something and they said, you know, be a bit more willow and less oak there, Patricia, you know. And I was like, grr, because I didn't want to hear that piece of advice at the time. It has never left me. Yeah. And it's about that.
Yeah.
It's about that.
I love the way they worded that.
Oh, yeah. Like you said, telling isn't going to help you, is it? Telling is going to engender a bit of, I'm not ready for that. But because I could see what they meant.
Yeah. I met a past pupil recently, Clangers. Unlikely he'll be listening to this, but I had this geography class that I referred to, geography, history, maths and P. I love the guys. I'm staying in a flat in Rap Mines. I'm cycling back and over. And I'm saving newspapers to make paper mache.
Oh, yeah.
Literally soak it in water. So over glue. A few weeks, then I had to get a teacher to collect the barrels and dry the whole thing out. And the one single geography class, I got three classes. I got the use of the science room. And now we're going to make sea stacks and cliffs. And
nice one, horse, yeah.
Bang, we're going to paint.
Love it.
Everything from UL is going to be applied. And they were there working. And I caught Clangers' eye. And Clangers looked me straight in the eye. And he flung. And the guy beside him went and flung the paper mache. And all we learned that day was static mites and static.
Well, that's good.
Clean up. And it's the only time I ever stretched myself to paper mache. So sometimes the steps we take can be a little bit.
Yeah, well, that's really funny. But
big too.
Yeah, static mites and static mites. But I have a great story about paper mache, which I'm going to share with you now. Which was when I did my master's. And you know, there was up and downs with that. That was a very interesting journey. Tough. Not about the content, not about the work, but actually about the process. Yeah. And I had a really good friend who was an art teacher. And I was like, I'm finished. And she said, what did you do with all the drafts? You know, and I said, oh, I still have them. And I'm going to shred them. And she said, no, no, no. She came up to the house with a bucket and glue. And she says, in they go. And we made a rubbish bin out of all of the drafts. And I kept that. And we painted it and drew painted frogs on it and all kinds of things. I kept it for years and years. And there was just something really therapeutic. Yeah. So when you're talking about the paper mache, I thought that was really.
Yeah.
Yeah, I love it.
I suppose I'm only thinking now that, that there is that element of trust in the boys. Okay, now maybe I just stretched that too much, you know. But there is the willingness to be creative, to see that something is possible. And creativity is often thrown out there as something that was, you know, willy-nilly, someone chancing their arm, often defined as something that's a mistake. You know? But I think it's Ken Robinson, the educationist, that defined creativity as being practical solutions that work.
Yeah.
Now, again, that starts with a problem. That's practical. So there's a problem. Now we need a paper guide. We'll make it without it.
Yeah.
But we need to support that encouragement to go and search for those kind of things.
Yeah.
And that makes life interesting. I mean, if you think going from the staff room to a classroom, if we're thinking of that way, if you're going to go and teach the stuff in the same way as you've always done it, you're set in your ways, gee, you're going to get bored. And there'll be no affirmations, there'll be no magic, there'll be no fella looking in you with the eye and throwing it up. But if you're going there, say, hey, look, I haven't tried this before. Let's work with me on this one. I'm sure in 45 minutes you'll be the wiser.
Yeah.
Tweak it a little bit more, a little bit less.
Yeah.
Can I ask you about your grandfather? I saw that all of your students, even though they never knew him, knew a lot about the man. So now I'm curious.
I'm the eldest of six. I lived in Ballygaddy Road in Tuam. And during summer holidays, Easter and Christmas holidays, I spent that time with my grandparents in Clonaglashagh, which is 6 miles out from Tuam. And yes, my grandfather, he was a funny man. He was seen in the village as being a man of humour and a man of work as well. And he prided himself in his work. Very quickly, I saw a difference in my grandfather from Clonaglashagh. Great crack, great fun. But when work had to be done, no great crack, no great fun.
Yeah.
Hay had to be saved, turf had to be brought in.
Yeah.
Sheep had to be dipped. And he was completely different that way. But he did share phrases with me. And I did, as the grandson, think they were granddads, you know, until later on in life.
Yes.
But, you know, that's what my grandfather said.
How do you know that thing?
But a huge impression of hard work, of diligence, of fun, of honesty. He was very critical of people taking shortcuts or not doing things down the line. And I remember sometimes seeing the discomfort that caused him, you know, when the swell of a village going a certain way and he was sticking to his line of honesty now.
Hard.
Yeah, I saw that when I was very young.
Yeah.
He had an impression in a slow way. It was only in looking back that I did see messages that he taught me.
Mm.
And hard work was... The hard work was the one that lasted longest.
Yeah.
I suppose the fact that I got into middle distance running, I did have, when I started in North School and started my coaching, I had a phrase, with hard work, guts and determination, you can achieve almost anything. Now that would have come, my grandfather would have said that. So hard work, guts and determination. That's the way I ran and that's the way I coached. After a while, I saw people who were not working as hard as I was were beating me. And consistently beaten me. And I did see a phrase, Roger Bannister, the man who ran the mile faster than 4 minutes, May 1954.
Yeah.
He said that the most important thing was not success. It was not the end line. He said the most important thing was the profoundly satisfying effort. And I'll come back to effort in a minute. In hard work, in thought, feeling and hard work. Now, I thought, gee, hard work, I'm in on that.
Yeah.
But the two things he had that I didn't have was thoughts and feelings. I wasn't thinking. Hard work, guts and determination. So let's say I was running 80 miles a week. There is no time to think. I don't want to talk to someone who says, Liam, do 60, because my friends did 80. So I don't want to talk to you.
Mm-hmm.
I don't want to Seb Cole that we had. He was doing 25. He became world record. I thought he was mad. I'm doing 80. That guy in England is only doing 25. So it was, I forgot where I was going, but it was part of that evolution of that hard work, guts and determination will only get you so far. But the profoundly satisfying effort.
Mm-hmm.
And if we really value effort, it's not a conditional reward we're giving someone. Like, let's say parents whose kids are doing the Leaving Cert now. If they really only affirm those who get good marks, that's a conditional affirmation. we should really affirm the effort mm-hmm. goes into it.
Mm-hmm.
And a man from your county, Brendan Kennelly, had a wonderful, he said that effort is the heartbeat of achievement.
Yeah.
And again, that means a letting go from the server or the hierarchy. Let's get effort. What's maximum effort mm-hmm. for you? And that can be very different from another person. So once we reward effort, we're really rewarding the steps
yeah.
that's vital to get. And the effort could be to sit down and think for an hour. Whereas if we only reward the person who's going running mad for the hour, maybe they should sit down for a half an hour too.
Yeah.
Maybe
yeah.
they
yeah.
should run for a half an hour.
Yeah.
That kind of thing. I don't know where I got to that now. But
no, but yeah. it's really interesting because you were talking about effort plus thinking plus feeling. And I was really mm-hmm. taken by those because that's a more holistic way of looking at even athletics or sport yeah. or whatever. It's the bigger picture as opposed to just the doing.
The guy to think.
I was very impressed with that.
I mean, even with Seb Coe, his dad was part of a culture in England and all, but he stepped back from it. No, this isn't going to work. You know, so how's his son feeling after running, thinking out about bringing in that engineering?
Yeah,
thing.
Yeah.
And of course, then now we all should do this.
Yeah. Yeah.
The search for perfection, sometimes we admire perfectionists, but I have found that perfectionists reach a very low bar. It's perfection over something that's nearly predetermined as being possible. Whereas the atmosphere or culture of perfectism is different. We will aim to do this as well, but we're going to stretch ourselves.
Yeah.
It isn't that it has to be perfect or the same. The outcome is it's going to be really, really good.
Mm.
But the steps taken are going to cause us to sweat a wee bit. They're going to cause us to be unsure. It's going to take longer than we thought. But the perfectionist sometimes gets a false reward. They're brought to a wrong place of certainty, where certainty isn't the world we live in.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
It's also a bit paralysing, I think, perfectionism.
Yeah.
You've decided on the goal and then this is so it must be absolutely perfect. It almost can stop you achieving it. For example, if you're writing a book or you're writing a play or you're you know, if you're in that creative or art space, things are never perfect. Yeah. You know, so you hold on. I see this with students who are researching, and as I'm saying, you know, give me a chapter of your work and I'll give you some feedback, and they just hold on to it.
Yeah.
You're like, well, I can't help you if you you have to let go of that needing to be perfect, because the job is about learning. It's not about being perfect.
Yeah.
These are apprenticeships in ways of doing as opposed to, and ways of thinking as opposed to end goal. So I think it paralyses people and stops.
Mm. Yeah. Seamus Heaney said he never liked writing, but he loved editing.
Yeah.
I love John McGartran's book, That They May Face the Rising Sun. Mm. It's hailed as a great book, but it took him 11 years. He said there wasn't a week that he didn't spend 5 days on it, and there wasn't a day when he didn't spend 3 hours on it.
Yeah.
11 years to write a book.
Yeah.
So he was making mistakes, come back and correcting, aiming for perfection. But not perfection, being a perfectionist.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
There's a big difference there.
Yeah. Mm. And there's a depthfulness in it. I mean, when you read John McGahern's work particularly, there's such a depthful wrangling with the culture of a time that you can see the amount of thought and feeling actually that's in his writing, I feel.
Yeah.
It's just incredible. So there is something about that time that's taken in that space that isn't lost, actually.
Again, if we stay with him, he said he didn't write books, he wrote sentences.
I might
be wrong now, but I think the first line in That They May Face the Rising Sun is that there was no wind on the lake. Now, we could all write that.
Mm.
In Amongst Women, the first line is, as Morn weakened, he grew afraid of his daughters. Now, I had 3 daughters, so I was in.
Yeah. I know, scary book though, actually. I think Amongst Women is a phenomenal book. But
it is.
Yeah.
Yeah. And again, a problem. As Morn weakened, he grew afraid. So perhaps good things start with a problem.
Yeah.
Mm.
Really interesting. Yeah. Well, I like that idea of being a writer of sentences. Mm-hmm. We had, a colleague when we were writing our PhDs, and we were here, that we had a colleague, and she'd sweep past. She had a fantastic personality, and she'd say, "How do you eat an elephant? Bite by bite, Patricia." And she'd sweep down the corridor. But actually, there was something really good in what she was saying, which was stop looking at the big picture and just do the next task and get there. And I find myself saying it now. I channel her in my supervision, but there is that piece about just being in the moment of the work as opposed to the big opus feeling of the work.
Yeah.
If that makes any sense, I think.
Small steps will get you there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
The longest journey starts with one step. And I mean, I have mentioned about the comfort zone a lot. And only recently I've been thinking more about teachers that had an influence on me.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm 67 now, and my first teacher was Sister Leo. Sister Leo died recently, just in a matter of a few weeks.
Mm.
But on the day she died, I knew she died. Now, I haven't seen her for 30 or 40 years. And I just thought, wasn't it amazing that us, who hadn't seen her in 30 or 40 years, shared around, word went out, Sister Leo has died. And I can't remember anything she taught me, but I can remember how I was fond of her. I can remember how I felt safe with her. You know, the big round gowns, I wouldn't have felt safe with all. I can remember asking me questions in later life. In later life is just in secondary school. But I wasn't always comfortable in the place, but
yeah.
Base. I've mentioned Brother Morgan. The guy who taught me how to swim was a guy who came down to Tuam from Dublin, and Larry Williamson. I was petrified morning and evening for an Easter week. I wouldn't have been in water before, but I can also remember that moment when, wow, I'm floating.
Yeah.
But the message I would give to coaches and teachers, they may have loved me or not. They may have loved teaching or not. They may have loved the subject or not. But the aim wasn't to make me comfortable all the time. The aim was to create an area where I would be uncomfortable and they'd help me.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes because we love what we do, and we might love the subjects, you know, and the way we love our pupils or whatever, we don't actually push them out of the comfort zone.
Mm-hmm.
Where I think that's the real, that's what they'll remember. They stretched me and minded me.
Mm. Yeah.
And were there when it didn't go right. And I was more able to try it again. I felt capable. The risk of failure was reduced.
Yeah.
And that comes with a starting point, as I'm not there to love them or keep them safe within limits.
Yeah.
I'm there to stretch them.
Yeah.
I love that you're saying there's kind of two parts to that, though. There's the stretching and supporting.
Yeah.
It's not throwing someone into the deep end and saying, good luck.
Can they swim?
You know, yeah, exactly. Yeah, that there's that balance and probably like almost a bit of a pendulum in a way in the learning journey.
Well, without the safety net, you're gone.
Yeah.
Because you will fall and get hurt and you're not going to try it again.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
It's like your reaction to their effort.
Yeah,
that has to be affirmed and a good debriefing or facilitating or whatever.
Yeah,
and I think when you're learning a new skill or you're improving your skill or you're whatever you're doing, like it is a bit like your mental Olympics to some degree. So you're meant to feel that it's not meant always to be easy. You will go through that disequilibrium. You will go through the why am I doing this, and it would be easier not to. But that's part of the stretching that you're describing, and you're on the sidelines. You're supporting and scaffolding and coaching and motivating, but the telling, the giving the answer just achieves nothing.
It's like Lanigan's ball, which is a step, you know, I stepped in, you stepped out. It's knowing when to step in and support and knowing when to step out and stay out. Brian Kerr, the soccer manager's sidekick, Noel O'Reilly, I think Noel might be dead 11 or 12 years now, but they were very much a pair. Noel came up with three roles of a coach that he was very proud of. He said that the role of a coach was to spot, to stop, and ops for a variety of decisions or selections. And he was very proud that the three words are the same four letters. And that became my focus for a while. Until I realised, unlike an awful lot of other coaches, he was this genius of a soccer coach who worked in the school for death, so he had a real feel for getting round to people and getting tactile stuff and everything else.
Mm.
But he saw his first role was to spot, give them a ball. How are they? Patricia, she's flying today. knee's a bit slow today, some person is left footed, some person's right footed, that kind of thing. He saw the role really as an observer, as an analyst, matching it to a blueprint, and then stepping in to say, well, this is how I can help today. So today it might be faster, it might be slower, it might be more, it might be less. But I think it's a real learning point from a genius that he saw that the first role was that someone might think you were standing up doing nothing.
Yeah.
But singularly doing the most important thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I like it because it starts where the person is at, as opposed to starting with what I want from you.
Yeah.
This is what I want from you today. This is my goal, as opposed to where are you? And I'll observe and respond, as opposed to, it's a different power base actually in engaging, isn't it? It's completely different.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I suppose if I wasn't teachers, that's what I'd like to empower teachers to believe in, that spotting. You know, that others might wonder what you're doing. There's either no noise or a lot of noise coming through your class. But that you're really getting to see the personality themselves and to give it that time. And the other thing I find with building or serving of people, it's best done one-to-one, I feel. Now that's a bit of an absolute, but there's no research on one-to-one. Because one-to-one, if there's a tape or a camera or an observer, it's no longer one-to-one.
That's true.
Yeah.
And I think when teachers or anyone who's in that role of service begins to trust themselves that when I relate one-to-one, now you can relate one-to-one in a group as well, it doesn't have to be just one-to-one, but you get to know their name, you get to know their characters, you get to know a lot about them. That's when the place of most potential really lands. The however bit is, one-to-one is a lonely spot. You know, if I'm my way with them talking to a group, there'll always be someone nodding, there'll always be a few staying awake, you feel okay, I've connected.
Yeah.
But if it's one-to-one and you're not connecting, by God, you die a death.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
But by God, you learn that.
Yeah.
And I did deal with someone who ended the feedback was, I got something out of that today, or the feedback was, I got nothing out of that today. And I tell you, after two or three consecutives, I got nothing out of that today, by God, I plan, replan, review.
Yeah.
So he who was being served was actually stretching me as well. So I would say to anyone who's dealing with that to get deep down into it, just like back gardens are more interesting than
I love that.
Get into the backyard of people, spend a little bit of time with them, get to know their names. What teams do they follow, what music do they like, what kind of car do they drive. You then get into the personality.
Yeah.
We have three questions, Liam, that we asked at the end of the podcast, and then, which I realise now that we have not shared with you. So, we're
going to
go for it anyway on the hop and see. So the first thing is actually probably the hardest one, but we may as well go with the hardest first. A leader that inspires you and why?
Well, I suppose the most unexpected one, and one I wouldn't have said for a long time. I'm the eldest of six, and my mother was a leader. But it's only recently I have tagged that onto my mother. The six of us are very different now, two boys, four girls.
Mm-hmm.
She wouldn't have been the kind of person to get up front, to speak out loud, to speak out into a group. But she was a person who led in promoting effort, which I mentioned earlier, this idea of making a mother, Monaghan's mother or something, and laughing at it. She didn't have a singular way of going, I've mentioned of that, but there were certainly ways of not going. There were certainly ways of conduct that had to be adhered to, helping out with neighbours, doing odd jobs with neighbours, doing your share in the house, that kind of thing. There was a real deference for authority publicly, I would say. Whereas then she was able to close the door and laugh and just get me that. That personal, and I got a great balance there of maybe a way you have, there's your personal self and your professional
public
self.
Yes, yeah.
I wouldn't have answered it like that before, Eve, because, and I suppose what got me around to that was in the last year or two thinking of a lot of the models of leadership are people who are loud, outgoing, confident, tellers in many cases.
Yeah.
Whereas I have found in my life the greatest influences are people who spent a lot of time on the sidelines but pushed me.
Mm-hmm.
So it wasn't that they led, but they pushed me and encouraged me and were there to pick up the bits.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But that is leading, isn't it?
That's, I think it's the ultimate now. Yeah. But you need great confidence in your skin, mm-hmm, to say, well, for my man would say, mother's sake, I'm going to do my real best with these. But it isn't something that was very visible to others.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And look, I'd have to put my hand up as a eldest son. I didn't see it for a long time.
Mm.
I joined the Christian Brothers when I was in second year. So I'm only 14. So I go to a novitiate up in Dublin. And it was good. I did leave after a year because it was only 3 weeks holidays. That's why I left. But my mum used to get me the Shoot soccer magazine every week when I was. So I was only in first year in Shoot. But it wasn't allowed in Baldoyle where I was. But my mother insisted that it be allowed. So I got Shoot in the post every week, wrapped up in a page of the Tune Mm. Herald. And it did the rounds of the school. There was about 30 of us in the school. And I did feel, gee, my mum insisted on that. I have Shoot, you know. And again, when you think back to that kind of time, fighting the system.
It's very special.
I get my son Shoot magazine, Mm. and I'm sending it to him. He's to get it. So there was that kind of gentleness in her, but then there was this little
shift.
No, that matters to me. And I'm not just saying that in an overly emotional, reflective way, but certainly as a contrast to what I see as being purported to be great leaders, I think there's a different type that really, really deep down give a springboard Mm. or a launching pad to people. Mm-hmm. And you don't get in their way. If this big leader is there, you have to kind of get around them or by them or through them. So the great leaders just open up the territory for and say, off you go. Yep. Let's do your best and I'll That's be it. There.
Yeah. I love that.
I love the piece about because your mum's also teaching you about sticking with something and not taking no when something important needs to happen, which is the connection with you through Shoot and giving you that something to hold on to that connects you to her and to home.
Yeah.
And just holding out for that.
Yeah.
And that teaches us something about how we are going to be as adults when we go forward, when something similar comes at us, that we can stick and be strong and say, no, this is, I love that.
Of people too, not only just family, but everybody, neighbours, putting herself out of the way to help people who needed some help.
That's good. That's lovely.
In a funny way, Billy Connolly, the comedian, she'd often give out about that very rude man, that Billy Connolly, terrible man. And she saw him in Clifton one day, and I swear she nearly got killed crossing the road to go over to welcome him. Oh, you're welcome to her. But it wasn't being artificial. She had a great warmth for people.
Yeah.
My role, he's now in my place. I'm going to warm.
He's going to have an Irish welcome.
I'm going to accept what he is and get that.
Yeah.
So I suppose that range, at a time when there wasn't a range or an acceptance for other people.
I love that. Yeah. The one and the many.
Yeah.
I really like that. Another question we ask, because I always forget the questions and Neva's looking at me. Well, another question that we ask is, when you look back over your career, would you do anything differently? I know these are...
They're big questions.
Little existential, that one. But.
My knee-jerk reaction is no. I did repeat the Leaving Cert. I did want to get into the PE college, as it was called at the time. I didn't do a better leaving the second time. It was no, and I did get in there. But the day I got the letter to say that I got into PE, I also got a letter from the Ordnance Survey to say I was accepted there to be a cartographer. Now, I did like geography.
Oh, nice.
I did like maps.
Yeah.
And I do remember thinking, as the eldest of six, well, if I went off now to get a job, it would make things easier.
Mm-hmm.
My dad, who was a clerk in the post office, he said to me, now, you have a decision to make, he says, but whatever decision you make, we'll stand by it. And he said, just think of it for a day or two. I remember that freed me up from the immediate short term. I think, well, I'll make things easier for others by going here. But, you know, he did free me up to That's make lovely. Things for a lot more difficult. Yeah. So that would be the only real path, I would say, that that was a very significant step for me. And then met my wife in college in the same class. Uh-huh. There was eight couples in our class, you know, an unusual class. So a huge amount stepped on from there, you know, the school, the NCTC, the sport, the continuation of what I loved. So, no, I couldn't. Mm-hmm. I wouldn't allow myself to get lumbered or stuck in the mud of a regret anyway.
Yeah, I think that's... Yeah.
But that gets back to what I started with. I've been lucky.
Can I sideline for a tiny bit and say, so when you come back onto the campus now, I mean, totally other place, what's it like when you think back on what it was like and what it's like now?
It's like,
what's
your reflections? I mean, the White House was the only building.
Yeah.
There was a courtyard used to ring in town to get sessions from him and come up the steps from the P building, which was the only other building. And if there was five or six people at the only phone that was here on the wall of the White
House,
well, you knew you wouldn't get five phone calls in the hour before you had to go back down to the next lecture. Coming off the main road, you really were coming into a tiny little boring. Anne Sweeney was the first lecturer I remember who had a car.
I remember Anne, yeah.
Little blue Fiat Bambino. And it was even rare for the lecturers to have cars. There was no car parks. The stables were stables that were going around.
Wow.
It's hard to imagine now it has grown in my lifetime so much. There was no computer on campus.
Mm.
You know, just there weren't very few houses around Castle Troy. Most of us stayed inside the town. So in both thought, in both the way it has grown as a piece, as a place of learning, in the diversity of what it has with medicine and music and sport and all, it is... I don't think anyone could really have seen how quickly it has grown.
Mm-hmm.
Because, okay, I'm 67 now, so it's 40 plus years. But I've nothing but good memories, and our group has stayed quite close to each other as well during that time, because we were, if pioneers are people who go into virgin territory and begin to do, we had that opportunity thrown on us, all right.
Yeah.
There was no one really there to compare us to, so... We were up there immediately.
But I think your group and many of you are known to have been pioneers here, then in the country and in the development of the discipline itself, even, or in the work with athletes and with sports people. There has been that same pioneering mindset seems to have followed the careers of many of you, I think. Would that be fair to say?
There was a gap when we were there, Patricia, and we went in the gap.
Yeah.
Now, I think a lot of us have been able to say, yeah, we fill the gap. But we also closed the gap to maybe the next 10 or 15 years coming through. So perhaps in our way of helping the next generation, maybe we weren't the best at that. You know, certainly there's a need for PE teachers. We run in the gap, but I think in many cases we figuratively closed it. Others just came in and took their place behind us where...
Oh, I understand.
We were leading the whole thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So maybe I wouldn't say it was a regret, but maybe to more quickly hand over to the next generation rather than finding after 10 or 15 years, well, that crowd aren't doing what we did.
Yeah.
But we didn't let them either.
Yeah. And you kind of have to build that into the thinking, don't you? You know, that sort of letting go a little bit or making space for, or, yeah, that's really...
Yeah. But that was the people who selected the group. And again, while we could say that's the way that God were their visionaries to pick those people, again, getting into that power of the person, I think if you tell a person, or not to tell you doesn't work, but if you give the opportunity to someone to lead, if you encourage someone by telling them they're great and helping them to be great, they will be.
Yeah.
And really, we were part of that generation.
Mm-hmm.
The others didn't get thrown on them, and the eldest maybe was thrown on the eldest. But it wasn't maybe thrown with the same generosity for the others.
Mm.
But it has changed. But the world has changed.
Oh, just a different world, yeah. For good in many, many, many ways. You know, I'm glad to see, even in my own time here, I'm just the growth and the more that we can do. I really love, you know, I think it's a blessing to be able to do what we do.
Yeah. The only way it hasn't grown is that the connection to people has diminished. Now, I'm not making a comparison on campus now. It's a bigger place. But because we were less time on social media, we were less time alone, we'd say, in our own cars, in our own motorbike. We were together more often. We didn't have that distraction. There wasn't too many choices of, well, do we go to the college disco or A, B, C, or D, or do we go back home again? We lived in bigger numbers.
That's
10 or 20 in a room.
Maybe. Yeah.
So that connection of each other and getting to know each other It mightn't have been most comfortable, but it was the way it was. There's a massive disconnect now.
Mm.
And people can choose to be hidden within a great place.
Mm-hmm.
Not really connected. They're there, they go with the flow, but nobody talks to them.
Yeah.
They put up the phone. So
yeah,
that's, but everything else, that's improved.
It's really interesting that you're saying that, because we're, you know, when we're, I'm looking around at a few bits around, that, you know, you, there's so much being talked about anxiety, mental health in students and all different manner and means of that. But the one thing that keeps coming through is belonging and connection.
Yeah.
They're the, and you've sort of given me a different lens to look at that now, because there is that a decreasing sense of belonging. But yeah. when you come through in a group like that, there is a belonging in that group.
Yeah.
But you could be now living in your own room, in your own accommodation. You can close the door. You don't have to speak to anybody. The headphones are in your ears when you go over to your class and come back. The headphones are on in the library. You can be in your car on your own, going to and from. Those whole, that whole connected space is decreasing.
And I think when you're connected to what's closest to you, you're better able to reach out further to others, so that you have that diversity. Whereas if you're unsure in where you are, you're not going to go to something that's less familiar. Connected, challenged, autonomous, and able to express our talents. I think they're the four real building blocks for anyone. We could be self-taught, but we're not self-made. We need each other. Challenged, we've been speaking a lot about that. The autonomous about being able to make decisions is a huge one. Again, learn to think for yourself. But then to express your talents in the way you can do it, that allowance of individuality, the bigger the group, the more same everything is.
Yeah.
It diminishes that kind of thing.
Yeah.
So we have branded gear, we have the same kind of phone, watch the same kind of Netflix things. That is a real challenge in place for us. Yeah.
That's why I get really worried when I hear people not reading, not going into the literature, not opening up their space, because I just feel that part of the learning to think for yourself is in, when you can, reading a wide breadth of literature. We've made reference to, I mean, Brendan Kennelly, one of my favourite poets. We've talked about McGaugher and others, but yeah, you know, there's a less and less openness to that level of reading, and that worries me too, because I do see a tendency for groupthink or for sameness in thinking when we're only exposed to the same algorithms of what comes up on your Netflix feed and your social media feeds. Yeah. You know,
we mentioned effort and hard work, and effort is concentration sometimes, and to read 10 pages is an effort of concentration rather than reading to and then going for the phone.
Yep.
Or being distracted by something else on an email or whatever.
Yeah.
So there are elements as well as kindness and honesty, but there is that ethic, like I mentioned from my grandfather, of just as a time where the dossing is over now. Now it's work.
Yeah.
We've got to work.
Mm. Yeah, I agree. Mm.
The last thing is, if you were to give advice on someone starting off on their journey, and you could think of that as teaching or coaching or sporting, individual, however way you want to interpret it, but what advice would you give to someone?
I quote Samuel Taylor Coleridge, and I say that he met my grandfather from Clonaglasha in Duddy's pub. It's a lie.
I was getting very impressed now.
And he asked him about advice, and my grandfather said, which is Coleridge's quote, "Advice is like snow," he said. "The lighter it falls, the longer it stays, and the deeper it sinks into the mind."
Wow.
Now, I claim my grandfather said that, and Coleridge got it by wrong.
Yeah, I love it.
So I'm reluctant to give advice. Yeah. The lighter it falls, the longer it stays, and the deeper it sinks into the soul. Advice and criticism and praise are all ways of engaging with people, all right, but by far the most effective I find is personal reflection. So I'm loath to really look, again I mentioned, look in the rearview mirror and tossing that over to someone whose life is completely different. So I am reluctant to do it, Lee, but I would say to be yourself and to test yourself, and you can test yourself in ways of, well, people won't accept that, or that's going too far, or you can't say that, but I would encourage people to get to that limit. Be yourself. Do what you think. And small mistakes, lots of learning, less chance you're going to make a whopper of a mistake.
Mm-hmm.
And yep. A mighty consequence to it.
Yeah.
And have three daughters, Aoife, Roisin and Leisha, same house, same parents, same food, same routine. Three entirely different personalities. Yeah. So if I was as their father to give the same piece of mm-hmm. advice, you know, just I don't listen anyway.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, that's very true. Yeah. Very, you know, yeah, the difference is in us all.
Be yourself.
Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. But, and as my own dad says, never let the truth get in the way of a good story.
Live my life that way.
Yeah. But I like the piece about, you know, snow falling lightly. Just, you know, yeah, that's a very good rule of thumb. Yeah. Around advice giving, actually. I think it's very clever.
Yeah. And there's no absolute. I mean, you can have qualified praise, you can have constructive criticism. There is that phrase, you know, people learn best when their moment of learning has come. So I'm stuck for the sake of now a little bit of advice. That can help. Or when you listen to someone and a solution, and now you offer a piece of advice or a solution, that can be incredibly valuable.
Yeah.
I think you earn a time and trust and relationship to get to that point where it's meaningful. Besides, often when we talk about advice, it's kind of thrown on, mm-hmm. just so we can move on to the next thing.
Yeah.
Didn't I tell you?
Yeah.
Didn't I tell you, but it doesn't land.
Yeah. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Liam, thank you so much.
Yeah, it's been great.
Fabulous.
I've only one slight problem with it all, which is I'm now going to have to go back to Giles and tell him he was right, which I don't like doing. I'm so delighted to have met you. Thank you so much for today. Really appreciate it.
Pleasure to meet the two of you. Good luck with everything. And I'm delighted with the chance to come back to campus as well.
Yeah, lovely. Thank you.
Thank you
very much. Yeah.